Welcome, everyone, to the Nomad on Fire podcast, the show all about the digital nomad lifestyle coupled with financial independence. We'll also be exploring tips and tricks on other lifestyle optimization strategies. I'm your host, Eric. Thanks for being here. Let's jump right in. Phil Lockwood, welcome to the Nomad on Fire podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have a fantastic story traveling around with your family. And yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of inspiring content and some great takeaways for the listener. So should be a lot of fun. So with that, if you don't mind, if you could kind of kick us off with just what your background and what your story is.
Yeah, I'm late 40s, by the way, although if you ask my kids, they probably think I'm late 30s because that's what I tell them every time, right? It's just a number. But so that's how many decades we're working with here. But, you know, the beginning of my story is pretty simple. I grew up in rural Indiana and didn't do much traveling at all. I suspect that comes into play into why I like traveling so much today. But I ended up going into the Air Force and, you know, I mean, my entire childhood. And then after graduation from high school, I was 100% sure I was going to be a fighter pilot in the Air Force. And I ended up going to the Air Force Academy for a while. That was the plan. And then just decided to change directions, got out of the military, decided I wanted to go into business instead. I wasn't very good at going to college, so dropped out a couple of times from CU Boulder. And that was after, of course, dropping out of the Air Force Academy. But decided to just kind of try my hand in this whole like web world. So started doing some freelance work with website design development. And within just a matter of a couple of years, turned that into actually starting my own agency, which I built from nothing into about a 70 person agency, serving a lot of big brands. So I've been running that for 20 years. And what that looks like day to day has changed so much over time, you know, from when we had a couple of buildings downtown with all the employees to being a completely remote agency now. It has definitely evolved over the years, and yeah, we'll get into that more, I'm sure. But that's the high level.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely want to dig in there. I guess first thing I wanted to talk to you about is kind of like traveling with the family. Like if you can take us back, like when did you all start traveling and sharing your journey online?
About a year and a half ago is when we went from having just our home in Denver to buying an island house on Coronado Island off the coast of California in San Diego. And that was like, all right, now we're just going to kind of go back and forth as much as we possibly can because we wanted to be able to enjoy that home. So that got us into a routine of, I don't know, maybe once a month, we'd be going back and forth. When COVID came around, it actually kind of locked us down at our Coronado home for the most part. But, you know, we got cabin fever pretty quickly and decided to join this program called Inspirato that we're really big into now. And it's basically the part that we do is a subscription program. So we're just paying a flat monthly fee for essentially unlimited travel, meaning we can take a trip and then the day that we check out from that trip, we can book another one. So there's going to be gaps in between the actual trips, of course. But that was unique because where maybe going to resorts or hotels was going to be really tricky during COVID, right? With Inspirato, they've got this portfolio of amazing, like multi-million dollar mansions all around the world. So we started going to places like Costa Rica and it's a cliffside mansion. So there's plenty of social distancing. You got to get through the airports, but I mean, they were dead. So that was actually not too difficult. Right. But I mean, immediately we fell in love with that lifestyle and we were just doing it as much as we possibly could. And honestly, after a few months, we ended up getting a second membership with them so that we could double up, overlap, you know, kind of leapfrog all of those trips because we just wanted to travel constantly. But yeah, the family dynamic is, it's really something. And anyone out there who does this with a family can speak to that. And honestly, you know, there are a lot of truly nomadic families, 100% full-time nomadic families who document this on YouTube, and they're doing it in a much harder way than we are, you know, living out of an RV or living out of a sailboat, things like that. And ours is definitely, it's more luxury focused. And so it makes it easier in that regard, but still it's a lot of suitcases and with smaller kids who aren't self-sufficient, it's a lot of stuff going through customs and everything else, you know, so much anybody who's not there yet, or doesn't get there, like really appreciate what you have in terms of being able to just travel solo or you and a partner, because it's a whole different world.
For sure. Yeah, that, it's so cool though. Like that's definitely, I mean, I love traveling, and then I also, you know, having a family and having children is definitely one of my life goals. So that's why I was so excited to talk to you today and learn more about it. How did that like initial conversation go with your children? Like, hey, we're going to start, you know, we're going to start traveling a little bit more. Were they nervous? Were they excited? Like, how was that dynamic?
I think we got them excited right off the bat. There were going to be some new things that we started doing. So my son, Colt, who's the youngest of our three, he's 8 right now, loves, I mean, wildlife, critters of any kind, but loves fishing. So I was like, you know what, we're going to Cabo for this first trip. We're going to like charter a boat and we're going to go out and we're going to do some like trophy fishing. And so he was super into it. And then I said, we're just going to make this our tradition. Every trip we go on, you and I are going to fish in some way, shape or form. My oldest child, daughter, who's 14 now, I got her scuba certified, and going on scuba dives wherever we could go that had scuba was going to be our tradition. And it was kind of a hodgepodge for my middle daughter, who's 10 right now. But they all really responded to it in a different way. Luckily, it was a bit of an easing in the sense that we had already planned to take our two youngest kids out of in-person school and put them in California Connections Academy, which is the state-sanctioned online school. And then my oldest daughter ended up getting out of in-person school because of COVID. So, you know, everybody was already out anyway. There was we didn't have a choice in the matter at that point. So, you know, for them, it was more like, do I want to sit around the house all day or do we want to travel? I mean, there was nothing about it. It was not appealing. But, you know, we'll have to get into a little bit into that schooling dynamic, because now that my oldest daughter's back in-person school, she has very specific desires around that that will certainly play a very big role in how nomadic we can be moving forward.
Yeah. Do you mind kind of sharing that? I think that's a good point. I guess I didn't think of that with all the schools are remote anyway. So it's like, oh, should I just stay at home and take these classes, or I can go on an awesome adventure. I think that's cool too, that you mentioned you kind of have those activities that, you know, the children are really interested in, and you can kind of do those in each of the places that you travel to. But yeah, have you thought about how that's going to look in the future with the schooling piece of it?
You know, I've talked to a lot of other nomadic families about how they do it. And I think a lot of it just comes down to what the age of each kid is when they start that lifestyle. And for our two little ones, I mean, it could almost get to the point here where they just don't really know any different. I mean, they're essentially in third, fourth grade when this thing started. And you know, I mean, it's been more than a year since the whole COVID lockdown. So this is already like the idea, the concept of in-person school is already so foreign to them. Whereas my older daughter, and number one, she's my daughter from a previous marriage, which plays a role here because she definitely has to be at her mom's house 50% of the time back in Denver. So as far as our travel goes, it's evolved to the point over the past few months here, couple of months, where she'll actually skip out on a lot of our trips because she wants to be there for in-person school. She wants to spend time with her mom and so on. But yeah, the other two, it really, I think, makes you a better parent to live like this because you can't take a lot of these decisions for granted. I think that living in a suburb and having friends who are all in the same situation as you are in terms of kids' ages, you all hang out together. It's really easy to get your kids off to school at the beginning of the day and then say, okay, they're in good hands. I don't have to worry about it. They come home. You know, sometimes you're in a good mood, sometimes you're in a bad mood. Sometimes you scold them. Sometimes you have a great time playing tag out front. It's just so easy to fall into that comfort zone. Whereas here, we know that we have a huge responsibility to make sure that their childhood is still as positive as it can be, that they're still having adequate time playing with people of their own ages, and that they're able to develop long-term relationships with people wherever possible. So it takes a lot of effort. And I feel like it makes me a better parent because it really makes you think about the sense of responsibility you have. You really take it seriously. The whole lifestyle in general, I think, does that in various ways. I think it makes me a better person, or it makes you focused on being a better person in general. But the parent dynamic, I think is paramount. So with our kids, they already had a lot of friends from their in-person school, from our old neighborhood. So we get them back together anytime we can. When we're back in Denver, for example, or when we're in Coronado, we get them together. There are other instances even here on the island where we'll get them together with other kids during the day, like for big play dates and that sort of thing. So it's that combination of just get them time with other kids so they can play, they can learn interpersonal interaction, but at the same time, really prioritizing those true friendships so that they, you know, they don't go off to college or something and be they're the only kids who don't have those long-term relationships and they feel like they've missed out on all of that history. I think that's huge.
Absolutely. What about while traveling, are there any good resources? Like, have you been able to meet up with other traveling families or expats in the area, or even, you know, local families so that the kids are able to play with people their own age?
It is hit or miss for us just based on our destinations. And there's not a huge expat component the way we travel, like I mentioned. I mean, sometimes now it is in big resorts or it's in neighborhoods, you know, where we just, it's not really conducive, I suppose, to that kind of a lifestyle. So we just don't run into many expats, but wherever possible, we get them together with other kids. So sometimes there are community pools at the resorts, for example, or even kids specific activities that resorts will do. And so they'll get to interact with kids in those times. A lot of times it does end up being we're a family, we're hanging out as a family for the next 7 days on this trip. And I think it's toughest for my oldest because she's the one who's like seriously a teenager going into high school. And she has these two small siblings who are practically twins, you know, who can really interact with each other all the time. So it's hit or miss just depending on where we're going, but we do try to keep the schedule so full that it's a great experience for them no matter what.
Absolutely. So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Inspirato Pass. You kind of touched on it a little bit, but do you mind kind of giving just a little bit more of a background? I was doing some research before the call, but I kind of wanted to just hear your experience with it. You know, would you recommend it to others? Kind of the cost that people are looking at if they're wanting to travel using that service?
Yeah, absolutely. Inspirato happens to be one of like three major players in this destination travel club space that are headquartered in Denver. And I think that's really just because the founders all came out of the same ones, which Exclusive Resorts is the granddaddy. I mean, this, don't quote me on these numbers, but even 20 years ago, I want to say you might have to spend somewhere between $100,000 and $250,000 just to buy into the club. And then you're still paying nightly rates to stay at all of these places. It was for, you know, multimillionaires only, of course. Now that price threshold has just been pushed down year after year. And it's to the point now where Inspirato, which still has amazing homes, had already gotten that club price down to an initiation fee of maybe $10,000. And then you're still paying, in some cases, massive nightly rates. A couple of years ago, they added the pass product, which is the flat $2,500 a month. And what you do is, when I was a kid, I used to like get catalogs with toys and stuff in there, and I'd flip and I'd pretend like it was a shopping spree where every single page I could pick one item, right? So I just go through there and like, okay, I'll pick that one from this page. It's just a fun little game. And it's kind of like that because the Inspirato website has all of these trips, and we're talking about, I mean, let's just call it probably thousands of trips. And if you want to narrow it down, you can. You can say, look, I know I only want to be in a beach type of vacation or snow or France or whatever. And then it'll filter the results. But then you just get all these little tiles with the little thumbnail images of every one of these places and the name. And it'll be stuff like, do you want to go to St. Croix from this date to this date? You know, and you click for details and view the photos and reviews and that sort of thing. So it's just like this little vacation travel shopping spree that you get to experience when you pick every single trip. And they've got, it's probably a very complex algorithm that they have, but at the high level, you have to understand that you can't expect to stay in this mansion in Costa Rica that we did like last October that is supposed to cost $15,000, even if you're in their club and getting discounted rates. You can't stay in one of those places every single month paying $2,500 a month and not have some kind of a trade-off there. And the trade-off is essentially that, like I said before, you can't book your next trip until the last day of your current trip. And you have to have a certain number of days in between each trip. And actually, I think it's either 2 or 7 days. I can't remember in between. So it's not like on the day that I'm checking out, I could say, okay, give me a new trip that starts today or tomorrow so that I just live on the pass. Typically, you're going to have minimum of like a week in between. And the selection of these places, which again is a combination of amazing homes, resorts, and hotels, is a much bigger selection if you are solo or with a partner, because then, you know, there are so many in there where maybe it's a one bedroom or a studio. I mean, you could get a studio in downtown Barcelona that's incredible. Not an option for us because we've got a family of five. So we do look for those really big homes whenever possible, or, you know, suites in resorts and hotels. But you could travel a whole lot more on that $2,500 a month if you had a smaller group, because you could take advantage of more of those trips that are available sooner. The other thing is, you'll notice when you look through the trips that the farther out you book, the more valuable the trips are, because they know you can't book another trip during that period of time. So you're still paying your $2,500 a month. So they're going to make more money. So that's when you can see stuff like $15,000 per night on Lake Como in a chateau or something, you know.
Yeah.
But the closer it is, the more you might see things like 2 or 3 nights in a studio or a hotel room or something that's in LA. So it's fun though. There's always been a really good selection. We've never been disappointed with the options that were available. And for us, it ended up being maybe every 4 or 5 weeks initially that we could get one of these mansion homes. And so we were focusing on those. And then, as I mentioned, it was to the point where we're like, well, we want to travel more than that, but we don't want to give up the quality of the lodging. So we bought a second pass, and there's a discount for that one. So I think we're paying somewhere in the neighborhood of $4,600 a month now for two passes. And then it opens up a whole new type of travel that we can do, where we just went to New England, for example, and we did a short week on Nantucket Island, and then flew back to the mainland and did a week in coastal Maine. So we just backed two of those trips right up to one another, single flight out from our home, and really, really cool trip. So
that's so cool. Yeah. So I guess, so if you have the two passes, this is super interesting to me. Like, I hadn't heard of Inspirato Pass until I started checking out your website. So I guess theoretically, if you had the two passes, like, could you continuously use that program and pay that set monthly fee and just jump from like trip to trip?
You could probably, I think that might be a reasonable assumption, maybe a few hiccups here and there, you know, you could grab a hotel room if you need to from time to time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, again, if it was like you only needed one bed at most, one king size bed, no matter where you stayed, I don't think you'd have any trouble being able to flip flop those back to back.
Cool. Okay. How about like the date? Like, does Inspirato give you the date ranges, or are you able to just say like, oh, this is a 12 night trip or whatever the case, or are you able to select those date ranges and then it just gives you everything that would be available for those date ranges?
You could do it either way. So you could go to the Inspirato website, go under pass, and then click, I think it's on trips, and just start looking right now. And you'll see it shows you everything by default. So if you don't care, if you just want to see maybe what's soonest, then you just start scrolling down the page. But if you know, hey, I need someplace for 7 nights at the end of August, then you can go and put that in there along with those criteria around things like where you want to go and, you know, the type of vacation, whatever it is, and it'll narrow it down for you. So we do a combination of those. As a general rule, we know when we want to travel, just so we can coordinate all of the trips we have going on. So we'll at least put in some sort of a qualifier by saying we want a check-in date of at least 4 or 5 days, and then it'll pull back things that fall into that. We usually, sometimes maybe we'll say minimum 4 nights or 5 nights, but a lot of times we just leave that alone and see what comes back.
Awesome. Okay.
So, cool. I should mention there technically is I think it's like a 1 month startup fee. So, you know, it's $2,500 a month, but to start up the program to join, it's like $2,500. We've been working with this girl, Charlotte, internally for all of our stuff. And she always has these really cool promotions that she'll text to us. And on our website, we have a little form. We'll make an introduction if anybody wants to take advantage of those. We've never paid on either one of ours, that startup fee, because we took advantage of these promotions. And I want to say we maybe have gotten at least 2 bonus trips from these promotions as well. So they're like, this one doesn't even count. Take it whenever you want. It overlaps whenever you want. Doesn't matter. Just like pick any of these places. Nantucket may have been one of those for us, actually. I don't even know if that was a back-to-back with our 2 passes. We may have gotten Nantucket for free. So.
Oh, sweet. But. Okay. Yeah. And I'll link up your site in the show notes. So if anyone's interested, they can check it out and fill out the form there. Okay. Cool. Before shifting gears, like, I definitely want to ask you about Distill. I want to ask you about Always Be Changing. But I guess before that, you kind of mentioned some of them, but do you have any like places that you went to or any experiences that just like really, really stand out to you that were just amazing trips?
Costa Rica was pretty much perfect. And it was only our second real pass trip. When we first signed up for pass, we did this Beverly Hills hotel thing for a couple of nights just because it was like, well, we're in the program, so let's do it. But it was our second trip. And after Cabo, which was also a mansion on the water. And I mean, Costa Rica just kind of blew us away. To this day, we always ask the kids, what's your favorite trip so far? And they almost always say Costa Rica. The house, and by the way, this is one of our primo episodes on our YouTube channel. You get a ticket. Just look for Costa Rica and you see this place and it's nuts. I mean, just overlooking the ocean, it's sprawling with this huge infinity pool in the back and everything. And we fit in like every excursion you could think of. I mean, we were in the jungle with monkeys, we were scuba diving, we were deep sea fishing. We did it all. So that was awesome. And we're actually going back to Costa Rica in a couple of weeks and really looking forward to that.
Oh, that's sick. That is awesome. What part of Costa Rica were you all in? Because I'm interested in Costa Rica. I've never been, but I think that's going to be my next international destination for sure.
I was just thinking today how awful it is that I know nothing about Costa Rica. I will tell you that we stayed on the Pacific side, and okay. It was Cocoa Beach, Pacifico, maybe. You could look and figure that stuff out. That's all I really remember. And I don't even know like where we fly in or anything. My wife is our travel planner. So I, a lot of times, just kind of go along for the ride. That's why I don't know anything now. And then our next trip is also going to be Pacific side, but about 2 hours south. Again, no idea. I can let you know later.
Okay. No worries. How about, so shifting gears a little bit, I wanted to ask you about your agency, right? Can you kind of talk about maybe the genesis of it? Like, did you use, so you're designing websites, is that correct? Like, I think you mentioned before, like, you know, decided like college wasn't for you and stuff. Was this a self-taught skill? Did you learn it online and then you enjoyed the work and moved into that? Is that the case? Or can you kind of just tell us about how you got started.
After resigning from the Air Force Academy, I moved back to Boulder, Colorado. I was like, all right, I'm going to go to CU Boulder and get a degree. I was doing night security for a biotech research company, multi-billion up there. So walking around doing my rounds at night with my flashlight, and there's a table in one of the office common areas with this huge red HTML book, like, you know, size of a Bible sitting there. I'm like, what the hell is HTML? And I pick it up and it says like, you can create websites. And I'm like, huh. So I sat down and I like started with page one and I just started flipping through and reading. And then it's got the exercise component, you know, like type this. And so I'm like, oh, here's a computer. So I got on there and just started copying this stuff. And I worked through that book in like 4 days. I was like, holy crap, I can make websites now. So I told one of my other buddies who had resigned from the Air Force Academy, and he's like, I'm doing websites too, and I could send some freelance work your way if you want. And I'm like, hell yeah. So we started doing that. And I mean, it was just, I was addicted to making sites. And it was probably within a matter of a few months that I got my first job making websites. It was like literally advertised in the newspaper, classified ads, you know. I was like going in for my interview, got the job, was there for 1 year. And then one of my friends got me a serious web developer job way above where I was supposed to be for this big consulting firm. Did that for like maybe 2 years. And then it was the .com crash. Mm-hmm. So got laid off And I was like, I do not want to try to find a job in this market. Everybody's looking for jobs. So I was like, I think I'll just start making websites for clients directly on my own. And that was it. I mean, the rest was history. It was like month by month, we were just doubling. Even though it was the dot-com crash, that meant that all of these big agencies doing websites, they were out of business. So we were just scooping up clients left and right, you know, building websites for pennies on the dollar, basically. But it was like gold rush for us. So yeah, we started off, you know, back then there was little beyond website design and development. You didn't have Facebook, you didn't have Google Ads, you know, none of that stuff existed at that time. So it was really simple. And over the past 20 years, we've gone on this arc where we've tried to add everything from lead generation and Google Ads and, you know, paid social and SEO and everything else. And recently we've kind of come back to, we just want to specialize. It's so challenging and inconsistent to try to do a lot of those digital marketing tactics. And what we've always been great at, uniquely great at, is website design and development, making really good sites. And so that's our focus today too.
Awesome. That's an incredible story that you found that book and just started working through it and just the evolution of everything. That's so cool.
Where would I be today if somebody had not sat an HTML book on a table?
That's awesome. So cool. So can you kind of talk about the shift to remote work? You mentioned that the agency, you had buildings downtown and now it's fully remote.
Yeah. We finally gave up our office about 2 years ago. So about a year before the pandemic, which was handy because we were already nice and streamlined. Yeah. With remote work. But it had gotten to the point where, you know, the 70 people, that was like in-house, you know, mm-hmm. butts in seats kind of thing. And just everybody crowded. And that was just, we did things differently at the time. But then over time, it was like, we really need to expand beyond the Denver market for our talent pool because it was so competitive. And next thing you know, I mean, we've got resources spread out all over the world. So many of them are like 1099 contractor people, so we can use them. We've got this big project and then we don't need them. So hardly anybody is W-2 employee anymore. And it just got to the point where even our three main directors, including myself, Tiffany and Carol, were spread out, where a lot of the time last year I was in Coronado, Tiffany's in Denver, and Carol was in Manhattan. So there was no logic remaining to try to maintain any kind of a physical presence. It just, there was no value for us at all. So it was a no-brainer.
Awesome. Any tips for anyone listening in terms of like running a fully remote business, in terms of like the cultural piece or some of those different things that you do to keep the like team together?
Yeah, I think the cultural piece, this comes up every time I do, you know, interviews, keynotes, anything like that. People are always wondering. And obviously it's a challenge no matter what. There's no way to make it the same as if you're going to have in-person teams. But I think the success that we have found really comes down more to the type of people we hire. It's not so much about how we manage them once they're on board, because there are just certain personality types that are going to do a whole lot better in a remote environment and others that don't. And I think that a lot of the people that we bring on board are they're less focused on wanting to have a cultural experience with work. And they think of it more as a way to build something and to make money in a lot of cases. You know, especially in the case of a lot of our freelancers, they're success motivated, money motivated, because they're essentially running their own little business as well. You know, so when you have people like that, they want to be efficient, they want to be reliable, they want to do good work, because they know if they don't, then things will change. So because of that, it's never been an issue of why aren't we having ice cream socials? Why? You know, where's the? It's been so long now, I don't even remember all the other things we do for culture, but. You see what I'm saying? It's like, right. It's just different expectations from the get-go. Now, beyond that, even if it's not ice cream socials or virtual ice cream socials, it's about communication. And, you know, having like Slack for our mm-hmm. agency has been really key. Having Zoom so that we're like doing daily video calls. it gets you such a huge way toward where you want to be. And those were things that weren't as reliable, you know, a decade ago. It would have been a whole lot more challenging to try to keep people in communication. So I think that's key. As long as everybody's able to talk throughout the day in a way that's efficient, then the communication lines just stay open, you know, and it, instead of us actually enjoying happy hour together in the office like we used to, now it's, we all did our individual happy hours with our friends and we talk about them the next morning. Where'd you go? What'd you try? You know, and so there's still that sense of sharing, even though it's on a different level, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I think you bring up some great points there. Like the new, I guess, company and position I'm in is definitely, I'm not fully remote, but it's a lot more remote, I would say, than what I was doing before. So like most of my coworkers are not in my same geographic location. I feel like from a cultural standpoint, I feel like you can still have a lot of like cool, like recognition and stuff over Slack, or you can have like fun channels, or just being able to hop on a Google Meet or a Zoom call just to chat with someone. I think you can get a lot of those benefits. But then like just remote work, having the lifestyle flexibility of it is just so much more incredible. Like if you need to run an errand, or if you want to work out or do something during the middle of the day, to have that flexibility. And then I still feel like you can have like a pretty decent culture piece. Like, you know, it's not like everyone's hanging out together and they're on a softball team or something, like those types of things. But I still feel like you can build like true relationships with, you know, your remote coworkers. If there's, you know, potentially like once a year or something, if there's some sort of in-person meetup, I think those can be fun and kind of re-energize people. Or if you've never met, you know, people in person, that can be fun. I had a similar experience. But I guess when, you know, more towards the beginning of the year, when companies were kind of talking about, you know, are we going back to the office or are we going to be a remote first company, right? They're kind of making those decisions. I mean, from my perspective, I guess, as an individual, like I love working remotely and all of the lifestyle and kind of travel benefits that come of that. But I was actually pretty surprised how many people, like just from talking to different people, like kind of wanted that office culture and wanted to go back. So I don't know. It's kind of interesting, I guess. From like I thought everyone loved remote work.
No, you hit it on the head. I mean, it really does come down, like I was saying too, I think it's just the personality type. So you got to hire accordingly. And I don't envy big companies that are trying to hire remote workers. You know, it's Fortune Fives. I mean, that's a challenge to try to sort through all of those personality types and understand who's going to be happy, who's going to be reliable, who's going to be productive, and who's not. So it's a whole lot easier when you're talking about SMBs.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. How do you think that works just in terms of like the labor market, or I guess the workforce in general? Like, do you think, you know, people are kind of going to, the companies maybe decide, hey, we're doing in office or we're doing remote, and employees just kind of adjust accordingly based on their personalities or just their, you know, what they would prefer?
I mean, it's a wild guess at this point, but I think things just naturally evolve toward the solution, right? And there are already tools in place to address a lot of the shortcomings, both from the employer side and the employee side. And employers, I think, by and large, the biggest concern probably is still productivity, followed secondly by the culture component. But let's be honest, no employer would care about culture much if it wasn't for the fact that they know employees are going to care about culture. And so it's a necessity, right? If every employee said, we don't care, then they're like, I don't care about culture either. But like when it comes to productivity, I mean, there are already, what is it, Fiverr or some of these crowdsourced kind of like Fiverr, you know, to get freelance design development work, you can actually monitor what they're doing on their computers. It's got the timer, you know, and you can see everything that they're working on so that you know, okay, they billed me for 8 hours today. They actually did work for 8 hours today. I was able to watch all of that work. And that's rudimentary, but there are going to be so many things like that and just new tracking paradigms where it's not about the hours in the day, it's about the objectives, right? So I know that you need to keep up on this amount of work. And if you can do that while also working out during the day and going to the dentist in the morning and going to the movie theater in the afternoon, go for it. I mean, that's what it should be, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that from that perspective, it's just a matter of time. It just comes down to processes and platforms, and it's gonna be there. But with the people component, same thing. I think it evolves where people think, look, instead of having to form and maintain my relationships in an office, I have to do them outside of an office. So I'm meeting people that I don't work with and spending time with them instead. If the idea is they just really need, they're you know, extroverted or just very social, you can do that just as easily outside of an office as inside, right?
So yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if companies adopt like some of those time tracking methods. I think for a lot of roles that are remote, it seems like it could be easily managed in terms of the workload piece. Like, hey, you have to, you know, you need to work on these projects, you know, estimated time is 40 hours a week or whatever, right? And it really depends, like, hey, are they making progress on these projects? Some of those, like, mouse, I don't know, the tracking of like, oh, is the screen on? Are you moving your mouse around? That seems a little draconian. I mean, maybe it would make sense if it was more like task-based. I don't know, but that seems a little too
it's
much.
It's nuts. One of the ways that we put Slack and Zoom to work for us is like daily morning huddles. So it's intended to be quick. This is actually a Patrick Lencioni thing, death by meeting, I believe. So it's like the stand-up huddle at the beginning. What are you doing today? You know, what are the half dozen things you're working on? This, and this. Okay, how about you? And you just go in a circle and you're like, okay. And if you want to make this more of a manager tracking kind of thing, then you actually put those into some sort of software, you know, project management application, whatever. But you understand what people's foci are for the day. And then whether it's at the end of the day or the next morning, you can say, how'd you do? You know, and you got that one person who shows up saying, I'm working on the same stuff today because they didn't get it done yesterday. You know, you have a problem, but it keeps it really simple. You know, everybody knows what they're supposed to be working on. Are you succeeding? Are you failing? That's what it comes down to.
Cool. Want to shift gears a little bit and ask you about Always Be Changing. So you mentioned last year was the website, YouTube. Did you start kind of all the content creation last year? Is that right?
We did. And it was very lacking in format and strategy for quite a while. I don't think it was until, you know, maybe a month or so after we started the Inspirato Travels that we said, hey, this could kind of be a theme for us. Let's make this a journey, documentation of the journey that we're taking here. So if you go all the way back to the really, really embarrassing stuff at the beginning of when we started the channel, it's just a hodgepodge of crap. So, but yeah, the focus now is basically this luxury family travel, you know, very nomadic, and we do, you know, kind of some sub themes on all of our travels. Sometimes it'll be a restaurant tour episode, and sometimes they're excursion specific. And always we try to do a lodging tour. So whether it's a resort or the home, we do those, and those are popular and really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point though, that you brought up of, you know, not really having a goal or strategy. I think that's really important though, for maybe newer content creators, of just doing it and putting it out there, kind of getting yourself into the habit, learning those skills, and then you can kind of develop that strategy later on. I remember for me, I went and listened to some of the like first few episodes of some of my favorite podcasts, which are really good, right? Like really well produced, great content. And some of the first few episodes were just like terrible, right? They were not very good. So it made me feel better of like, hey, you know, I'm starting at this place, you know, I can always grow and evolve. Like the most important thing is just to build that habit and keep it going.
Absolutely. You'd probably be hard pressed to find a big time YouTuber where that's not the case. You know, I mean, Mr. Beast, Mark Rober, go back, you know, they've got maybe tens of millions of subscribers right now, but go back, they're all going to be embarrassing in the early stages. So yeah, absolutely. Just get started and get used to it, because especially if you're not a natural performer, the best way to become a better performer is to just, you know, that's the repetition. And I mean, we still have such a long way to go. It reminds me actually of when I started making websites, because I remember the very first one I made, I was like, okay, now that I've made it, I'm looking at it as a piece of crap, and I know I could make one a lot better than this now. So I'd repeat the process, make a new site. And by the time I was done with that one, I'd already learned so much more. I was like, I can make one way better than this now. So it's like, it's almost like this driving in the rearview mirror kind of concept, where you're never really satisfied, because just with the time that it takes to actually produce something that you filmed maybe weeks ago, you've already learned so much more, developed so much more, that it's kind of painful to watch some of that stuff and know it's not up to the standards that you have at that moment. So it's an interesting paradigm. But
it sounds like a good problem to have, though. Better than if you feel like everything is at the same quality and it's not evolving.
Yeah. But I tell you, YouTube, in my experience, is a much harder nut to crack. It's, you know, we started our Instagram channel more than a year ago. And I think we had like 2,500 followers there within a month or something. And after a year, more than a year, we just surpassed the 1,000 subscribers mark on YouTube. You know, and now it's accelerating, of course, but there's just, I mean, number one, you don't have as many people on YouTube maybe, or there's just a different thought process for people who were on there. So the idea of subscribing to an ongoing video program essentially seems like a bigger commitment to a lot of people than just clicking follow on Instagram or like on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So, but like you were saying, it's still niche is paramount. You know, like if you can find a very specific strategy, that's the thing that would help you grow more quickly. And ours is tough, you know, travel, narrowed down to family travel, narrowed down to luxury family travel. That's still huge. You know, there's no sliver there. And so it makes it a whole lot slower. But one of my friends who's a professional YouTuber out here started off doing everything from like interviewing entrepreneurs to doing fitness challenges and that sort of thing on his channel. And after years, found he'd made this one video about a workout challenge that really did well. And so he's like, all right, I guess that's what my focus is. And now he does nothing but fitness challenges and he's blowing up. So,
wow. Yeah. That's another important point of kind of putting the content out there and releasing it, right? To get that feedback and see, you know, what types of content does well and what the audience, you know, wants to hear more of. I think that's a great point. What are some of your, you know, future goals for the channel?
We'd actually like to make a business out of it. So maybe at some point here, naturally, in a matter of a couple of years, things would transition more from me spending day-to-day time with Distill my agency into just focusing on this. We're just at the point, we just monetized on YouTube, but you know, we're talking about dollars at a time, so it's not going to pay any bills. But we're starting to get more like in-kind kind of stuff. Our trip coming up here for Costa Rica, that's 7 nights in another private villa. It's probably a $15,000 value that we're getting for free in exchange for doing the content around it. Awesome. So yeah, I mean, it's just a matter of, I probably within the next year, it'll be transformative in the sense that we'll probably be doing almost all of our lodging for free, doing a lot of restaurant and bar experiences for free. So even though those are in kind, it's stuff that we would ordinarily be paying for. And for our family, I mean, that could equate to tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars over a couple of years, you know, in savings.
Yeah.
But that'd be fun. It's one of those things where, you know, they say, just do what you love and the money will follow kind of thing. That's really our mindset. I don't think we're unrealistic about the time frame. We know that it's going to be a challenge. And in a sense, I kind of like that. I like that YouTube is hard. You can't just snap a picture with your phone and get a million likes, get a million followers, you know? So it weeds out people who aren't committed because you need to be consistent. Yeah, getting to the point, I think where that was our main source of revenue, be able to sell my agency and then travel even more full time. And just we'll see, have to see how that times out with the dynamic of kids and schools and everything else. But I think it would just open so many doors to be able to have a resource like that, an asset like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'll definitely be following along with your journey and see how it evolves. It'll be exciting to see. One, I guess, before shifting gears here, one last quick question on YouTube. Is it a shared between you and your wife? Do you both work on things? Do you each have different pieces in terms of like filming or editing that, or do you share the responsibilities like 50-50?
Somewhat recently, we just finalized our strategy of having her do all of the editing. And then we both do filming. Technically, you kind of have to get multiple angles. And sometimes we're not even together, you know, on excursions and whatnot. I am the main photographer, videographer, I guess. I'm the one with the fancy camera equipment and the drone and everything. And she just uses her iPhone right now. So those are kind of our rough split of roles right now. But we both have input, you know, across those sides. So we analyze the footage, which still has such a long way to go because I'm not a photographer. So I don't, you know, I'm still trying to learn how to use the camera. So we're just constantly learning what are the problems with sound on this one? What are the problems with lighting on this one? And then when it comes to editing, you know, and especially the story, like we're very collaborative on that piece, you know, like, this part drags on a little bit, the pacing's off there. So it's very collaborative, but yeah, it's kind of an even split in terms of roles, although she puts in more hours because editing takes forever.
Oh, I can imagine. I've only done the audio editing for podcasts, but I can imagine the video editing so much more complex. Cool. That's awesome though. I definitely wanted to ask you about that. That's cool that you have that kind of, that you share and you work on it together. That's really neat. Sweet. Phil, this has been a lot of fun. I just wanted to ask you one more question here and then we can wrap it up. I like to ask, you know, guests on the show kind of about daily habits or routines. You know, what are some of those things that help keep you happy, healthy, productive, kind of all the above? You could take it any direction you want.
Well, I will say that I have always had a problem with doing the same thing every day, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think I'm just very restless. And that's why I think I got into the Air Force Academy, which is a lifelong dream. And then I'm like, kind of bored. I want to go do something else, you know, and leave, switch directions. So for me, things just need to be constantly changing, which is why the name of our channel became Always Be Changing. It's also one of our company core values. I mean, that's who I am. That's who we are. So, I have these practices. Number one, I really like working out. So that's particularly challenging with all the travels. And I actually kind of focus on that in some of our content, like trying to fit in certain things. It's like, I got nothing to go off of. So I put my kids on my back to do push-ups, you know, or if there's a resort gym, I'll try to take advantage of that. Or, you know, scuba diving actually burns a lot of calories. So, you know, using some of that. Here in Coronado, I signed up for the gym. So I've been there every single day trying to take advantage of it. That's a big one for me. And I don't have to restate any of the benefits of working out. Everybody knows, right? But on a different level, I started doing something a few years back. It's like my morning routine. And I'll get up when everybody else in the family is still in bed. So it's just my time. And sometimes I would do meditation. I've never really gotten locked into that enough to be consistent with it. But I started this document where I would just put notes, things that I want to remind myself of. And I call it my story. So it's really just a bulleted list. And it's now like 10 pages long, single spaced on the Google Doc. And so I just pull it up and I read through it because there are things that we think about ourselves, things that maybe motivate us or just, you know, remind us of certain ideas or beliefs that can be easy to forget day to day. I read them every single morning so that they're reinforced. Now, I have no problem doing this consistently every single day, but there are periods of time where I'll feel like it's actually limiting me more than it's helping me. So I'll take breaks. And I actually just stopped that break this morning, read my story for the first time since probably last year. So it's like reading the same thing every single day can sometimes, I feel like I'm locked into that thought, those thoughts, those ideas. And so I want to put it off to the side and get out and explore and expand And so I'll just take a break from it. It's like anything else, you know, if you're not feeling it, just step away for a little while. So I'll do that from time to time, but that is without a doubt the biggest daily routine that I have done over the years, and super, super beneficial in a lot of ways. And it's kind of hard to explain. I've done this actually on other podcasts. I tried to walk through it with people, but it's constantly morphing. Sometimes I'll pull in like the Think and Grow Rich affirmations that you have to go through, but it's just stuff that I want to reinforce in my mind. That's the simplest way that I can put it. And so mm-hmm. to be able to read through that stuff, I think just really helps get me started in the right mindset every single day. It equalizes the mood, you know, no matter what happened the day before, I wake up and I calibrate.
That's really cool. I mean, I'm definitely a big into journaling. I've been doing that pretty consistently for probably 6 years at that point. And that has been really helpful for me to kind of look back and just see what I was going through, how I was feeling, you know, look at my notes. Maybe I've dealt with this problem before and handled it well, or I handled it poorly and can kind of see that. But I haven't heard of that, like the story concept. That sounds really cool. I'm going to have to look into that a little bit more.
Some of that comes from Tony Robbins, by the way, the name story, by the way. But I like the journaling thing. I've done that. That's something I need to do more consistently. And what I love about that is it does allow you to be different every day. So you'd avoid that tunnel vision that I was talking about with the story. So good for you. Love it.
Cool. Phil, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being on the show. If people want to connect with you, they want to learn more about you and your story, where's the best place that they can find you at online?
I'm super active on LinkedIn, so you can connect with me there. My email addresses are pretty much everywhere on all of our websites, so you can always do it that way. But social media as well, got all of our channels listed on our website, which you'll have in the show notes. So yeah, I would love to connect with anybody out there, especially involved in Nomad and the FIRE movement. So yeah.
Fantastic. I will link them up in the show notes. All right, Phil, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Eric. All right.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Nomad on Fire podcast. If you like the show, if you could do us a huge favor, and please subscribe on whatever platform that you're using to listen to this. If you could also leave a 5-star review, that would really help us out and allow the show to be available to more people. See you next time on the Nomad on Fire podcast.